That we've got off on another subject.
Yeah, I know.
So at any rate, they decided that for money you can get things, but it was for big money. In other words, you could buy guns or buy ammunition, or if you had more money than the normal, buying it through normal channels. So they decided to come to this country, and they sent representatives. This representative, who came from the kibbutz, as I mentioned, Ein HaShofet, was therefore dispatched. But because the British knew about this, they threatened the United States with non-cooperation on certain post-war issues if the United States did not put a stop to the activity of the Haganah in this country. The United States, I must say with respect, did look the other way. However, the British chose to embarrass the United States, and during that time, 1947, they actually had 9 Secret Service agents assigned to this country alone just for this purpose of identifying where the money was coming from. Not that they could do anything about it, except they could make it public. Mm-hmm. And that would embarrass the United States government. So that's why this man explained that to me, that there was no way that they could raise money publicly and embarrass the United States government. And obviously it couldn't be, as we know it now, a deductible expense. So it had to be pure largesse. And he said, how can you do this for me? I said, well, we're without the sources of administrative staff, it's pretty tough. But nonetheless, I did personally organize an idea of mine that we would have what I remembered, the, what do you call, the pyramid letter, or the, what is the word? You know what I mean.
I know exactly what you mean.
And I hit upon the idea, and apparently it did work out, that what we would do is that I would invite 10 people who I thought had the capacity to do this kind of thing to meet. As a matter of fact, my closest friend at that time owned the 7th Avenue Hotel, and we therefore met there. And we had 10 of our contemporaries and friends, some all veterans, meet and decided that we would ask each person to give $100, and that we would ask each person there to call a meeting at his home and invite 10 people, and so on. And I don't know what you call it. Chain letter.
And
it worked out. And then it turned out that in a period of 30 days, without any publicity and without any support from staff, we were able to raise $30,000 in cash. I mean, cash on the line, not in pledges, that he took back with him. Now, what did he do with the money? There were guns available in this country. Obviously, there were a lot of Jewish merchants who were able to reach it. And by the way, this project was under the chairmanship and control of Rudolf Sonnenborn. I don't know how knowledgeable you are about that name. Rudolf Sonnenborn was Kitty Falk's brother from Baltimore, one of the wealthy Jewish families of America. And Rudolf Sonnenborn was the head of this. At any rate, he coordinated the national effort. At any rate, it was not long after this that a boat loading from a dock in Newark, New Jersey, the crane carrying a huge box labeled books for Palestine fell, broke apart, and was full of guns. And it made all the front pages of all the newspapers, New York Times, the Washington Post, so on and so forth, and the American government actually put up a big front of, oh, how could that happen, and so on and so forth. But nonetheless, these are the kinds of things that went on, and there's a lot of stories about how the Jews of Palestine managed to organize and save themselves in battles, being surrounded by enemies, battle to save and develop the state of Israel. Mine is one tiny little fragment of that. The best to know, if you're really interested in knowing about this, is to read the book of the life, the autobiography of Moshe Dayan, and he talks about these things in great length.
Thank you, Lynette.
I haven't talked about my personal involvement and my wife's personal involvement with the radio station WQED-FM. It has a pertinence in a certain sense about where, how the Jewish community was not generally accepted, and how lingering anti-Semitism remains perhaps even till the present time. In 1961, when I returned to Pittsburgh after an absence of 6 or 7 years in preparation for my specialization, I was shocked and pleasantly surprised to find that in those days I had to go from hospital to hospital, really beating the bushes, so to speak, to find patients. And to get into the car and tune in a station that played classical music. I was not accustomed to that, having left Pittsburgh in 1955 and none such existed. But having been in New York for many years, I got used to WQXR, and I bemoaned the fact that we didn't have something like that in Pittsburgh. Well, sometime in, I guess, 1961 or 62, this started, and I was so pleased and surprised that I called that station and volunteered my services to help them with fundraising. The man who ran the station was a fellow by the name of Jack Summers. Jack Summers and I and Sadell became very close friends. He was of Greek origin, came from Minnesota, and was really in theater more than he had been in music, really did not know much about music. But nonetheless, his wife's name was Cece Summers. I don't remember her maiden name. I think it was Kelly. Her father, she came from Chicago, from an Irish family. At any rate, we were very close. We were so close, as a matter of fact, that Chris, Chris was her son by a former marriage, and Chris became a pianist. He learned to play the piano on our grand piano, which is sitting right out there that you can see. Chris used to come here after school and practice at nights because they did not have a good enough piano. Chris is now a very successful concert pianist. So that's just to color the picture of our closeness. My involvement with QED was to help Jack Summers, who was new in town, and Cece Summers meet people, and particularly, naturally, people in the Jewish community, since that's where I was best known. And we arranged to have lunch, have them for lunch and have them for parties, and I had to meet people downtown. I called a luncheon and got some attorneys together and so forth. And I did these sort of things because they were always looking for money, looking to expand their exposure. And it was this way that I felt I could help best. Jack Summers had a dream, and one of his dreams was to develop a piano competition that would be internationally known, where people would come from all over the world to compete. And as a matter of fact, did rather successfully start a piano competition which ran in Pittsburgh, I don't remember, probably 3 years, 4 years, something of that sort, with very top quality contestants from all over. The first prize was $1,000, and we had the cooperation. I was very instrumental. I was actually chairman of the committee. We were very instrumental in getting the prize money and getting money for advertising and publicity and so on and so forth. Now, actually, WQED-FM was a subsidiary of Western Pennsylvania Public Broadcasting, which was a board of directors directed toward the very successful television station, which had originated here in the 40s, one of the early television public television stations. It originated in Oakland, right, as a matter of fact, right next to where I lived, but right next to the Ruskin Apartments. But nonetheless, the people on the board were not attuned to the idea of a fine arts music radio station, and they appropriated very little money for the radio station. As a matter of fact, I'll tell you, they appropriated $62,000 a year, which had to pay the salary of the technicians and the equipment and so on and so forth. It was just almost an impossible task, not to mention buying recordings and paying somebody the sophisticated discs that we have today. So at any rate, Jack Sommers needed all the help he could get, and we were very much involved in that, besides giving substantial amounts of money to it and raising money for it. For these projects. We just assumed, therefore, that we were part of a group. However, my wife, who was very knowledgeable about music, had been a singer in New York, a classical singer, and had an excellent voice and excellent command of pronunciation of foreign names, so forth. Jack Sommers' suggestion, developed a radio program on opera, and it ran for a couple of years. Once a week she would prepare programs, and so she had a major involvement, and as a matter of fact, after a time it became so successful they wanted to continue it. Jack Sommers actually paid her a stipend of that time, I think $5,000 a year, and as a matter of fact the money for that stipend she and I raised from friends to donate to the WQED because we wanted to put the program on an official basis. So I just tell this story because to show how closely involved we were. WQED at that time, and up till recent past, had the concept that part of their job was to make goodwill within the community. So it was a very frequent thing that they would have parties. They would entertain out-of-town guests, particularly guests of some moment in the musical world. And our being close to this organization and having a beautiful home, beautiful and spacious home, we were oftentimes asked to entertain guests, to invite people to dinner, to entertain for parties. And on one occasion, and perhaps we'll get to the point with this, on one occasion, there was the Chinese Opera Company, which was a traveling opera company, came to Pittsburgh to perform, and they performed on WQED FM. They decided to entertain friends to meet the company, showing hospitality, and they did so at our home. The next day in the newspaper, an article appears which says that the Chinese Opera Company and so on and so forth was entertained by WQED at the home of a friend. Those present were as follows, and they list the names of the people who were involved in the committee for the opera, bringing the opera company to Pittsburgh, and they left out all the Jewish names, including a person who was not Jewish, but had a foreign, sort of foreign sounding name, who happened to be a neurosurgeon by the name of Peter Sheptak. Peter Sheptak's a friend of mine, he's a colleague, neurosurgeon. And so naturally he and his wife participated through our influence. So we were rather surprised about this, rather dismayed. We wondered what it was all about. We naturally thought, why would they not put art at the home of Dr. and Mrs. Leigh Kessler, So we realized this was clearly an anti-Semitic gesture. However, there was one monkey wrench in that logic, and that was, why did they leave out Peter Sheptak's name? It turned out just by coincidence that I was sitting at Montefiore Hospital at a luncheon table, and I hear this discussion that goes somewhat as follows. I was out with some friends the other night, and they said, and I heard them say, they didn't say to me, but I heard them say, oh yes, it was operated by Dr. Sheptak. You know, he's a Jew. Well, the reason was that Dr. Sheptak was on the staff of Montefiore Hospital. It was the logical assumption, therefore, that Dr. Sheptak was Jewish. After all, it's not Smith, it's not Jones, so it's something that those people can't spell, so therefore it must, and he's that moniker, must be Jewish. That completed the circle. I then understood why they also left out Sheptak's name. I wrote a letter to the head of QED, both the board, president of the board, and the director of the TV operations, a somewhat vehement letter, and I got back, if I ever got back a letter that was written in platitudes and non sequiturs, that was it. It was clearly a letter which was that blamed no one, as a matter of fact, blamed the newspaper for that, did not take any responsibility, denied any evidence of anti-Semitism. I then turned it over to the Anti-Defamation League, and they chose not to pursue it. They said they could never prove it. It would be very hard unless somebody got fired because they were Jewish or something. But since we weren't on the payroll, it was hard to pursue it. But this was somewhat of an example. We, therefore, from that point on, started to cool our relationships with the this channel until shortly after that, my wife's program was discontinued.
What year?
That was, I don't know the year, but that was probably about 1967 or 68, 69, that, the latter part of the 60s. And we, of course, discontinued through our friend who was underwriting the program, discontinued the donation. We then had dinner with Jack Summers and his wife, Cece, and not a word was said about this. We had been very close friends. Matter of fact, the children were little at that time, even called me uncle. It was a very ugly thing. We therefore, from that day forward, never participated. We analyzed it from many points of view. One theory was that this Cece Summers did everything to try to ingratiate herself to certain leading contributors like Elsie Hillman, but I know Elsie Hillman better than that. I couldn't believe that Elsie Hillman would have been responsible for that. So that we always felt, and to this day it's never been resolved, but listen, when a station like this leaves out all the Jewish names who are contributing to their organization, you have to know that somebody there, first of all, was anti-Semitic, and second of all, it was supported by the executive staff, or that somebody would have been gotten rid of, or at least we would have been said, it would have been said to us, come on, now you know we're not in that category, we want your help. We faded out, nobody ever called us again, we had no further relationship in the past 20 years with that.
Do you think it still is going on today?
Well, Cece now is retired. She's tried to be friendly. And, you know,
I've heard her.
She tries to be friendly, and you know, we have a cordial relationship, but I vowed from that day forward, and I told you it was in the 60s. It was probably later than that, because I think that it was probably the 70s that Sydell had that program.
I still hear her on the
But she's not. She's really been kicked out.
Yeah.
We know
should
that.
Have been
fact. And it should have been 20 years later.
Yeah.
But she was difficult to get on. Jack Summers died, Jack and I never, and we never, we felt bad about it because we knew in our own hearts that Jack Summers was not responsible, whoever was, and we felt it was the head of the organization who we thought was it.
Yeah.
I don't remember his name.
The guy who made off with all that money.
Right,
and,
exactly.
And that son of a bitch.
You're being recorded.
It's okay. Excuse me, you're supposed to be talking.
What was his name? I can't
try to think.
But nonetheless, we,
he
wanted to get rid of me. I know he did because Jack Summers had enticed me into forming a subcommittee or a sub-board to support the radio station, since he was not getting support from the Western Pennsylvania Board of Public Broadcasting for his interest. And he came to me and he said, I have carte blanche to do this, and in that room I had a meeting of some very important people, the head of a steel mill, the head of a major non-Jewish legal firm, mm-hmm. the head of a major Jewish legal firm, myself as the head of a major hospital, and so we had a what I call a blue ribbon committee that was willing to pitch in and help the FM station, which I organized. We had two meetings in this room, and all of a sudden I heard nothing more. The whole thing was silent, and we realized that what was going on was Jack was being told, get rid of those people or else, and I'm sure that that must have been what happened. Poor Jack died shortly after that, so we never had a chance to reconcile with him. But it was interesting that after having two meetings at his behest in my house and bringing these people together, suddenly I never heard from him again.
So, you want to stop that?
We became interested in the symphony when we first came to Pittsburgh and became very much involved in the symphony, mainly because of our interest in music, but also because of contacts. For example, the associate conductor of the orchestra when I came back and opened practice was a patient of mine. His wife was a patient of mine. We became very close friends. They met my wife, became very close friends. Our associations tended over the years to be more in line with the musical community than with the physicians community. This continued throughout our life in Pittsburgh, and because of that, we were regular season ticket holders for the symphony. And it came through this same system of connections. Very close friend of William Steinberg, who was the music director of Pittsburgh Symphony for about 25 years. Because of our connection, we did many things for the symphony. We contributed a reasonable amount of money each year, not a huge amount, but a substantial amount to belong to what was known as the President's Club. We entertained for the symphony. Always had a couple parties a year. That was a custom in those days to, when you had visiting artists, to be able to have a party so that people could meet the visiting artists and the artists would have some place to eat, so on and so forth. And my wife was particularly skillful at providing that kind of repast, so that it was a very common thing. And as we sit here, we're surrounded by photographs of many of those people who came here under those occasions. It so happens that we were very close friends, my wife having grown up with the Beverly Sills, who was, of course, one of the major figures in music in America during those years, and we still are to this day friendly. So through her, people would come here and look us up, and when she would come, she would stay here, so that we've had many contacts within the community, and among our close friends have been the directors of the symphony, and in addition, the managers of the symphony. Gideon Teplitz, the current manager, there's his picture. Marshall Turkin, there's his picture. Isaac Stern was surrounded by many pictures. Beverly Sills, Alexis Weisenberg, and so on and so forth. But the point is that we've had an intimate contact with the symphony in various phases of the symphony. Now, it's interesting because most of these people, there's Sasha Snyder, who had the Lincoln, the Kennedy Award, was one of the Kennedy Award winners, one of the great violin teachers of this country, Sasha Snyder, and so on. But all these people are Jewish. There's Sidney Hart, a major violinist in this country and a major conductor in Europe and in Africa, and they're all Jewish, and we're in a very close relationship. But the board of directors was just the opposite. So we have never been, we're never involved or entertained the idea of being asked to be on the board of the symphony. This is, to me, another manifestation of anti-Semitism. Now, it doesn't mean they don't have Jews on the board. They do, and now they have more than they've ever had. But again, it goes back to Charlie Rosenblum. Charlie Rosenblum, now deceased, Jewish, married to a non-Jewish woman who was part of the symphony. He was vice president of the orchestra for many years, was never asked to be president of the board. So that even where they made exceptions and put a Jew on the board, it just never came to pass until last year that a Jew has ever been president of the board. It's interesting that last year they appointed as president the head of Duquesne Equities, Moritz. I don't know if you know him.
I can't remember. Didn't work for CNG.
No, it's Duquesne Light. So, it depends on the corporation. The corporations rotate seats, and this is a corporate town. The corporations, by and large, are anti-Semitic. Now, Donnie Moritz, that's his name. Yeah. Donnie Moritz is a very nice man and very Jewish, and he never hides it in any way. But why it is that suddenly they agreed to do this, but this is the 100th anniversary of the symphony this year, and finally there's a Jew and a major performers, major conductors, major contributors have all been Jewish, not to mention Charlie Rosenblum, one of the richest men in Pittsburgh, who was vice president and never asked to be president, and we've never been invited to be on the board. This is my concept is this is a subliminal form of anti-Semitism. Things are beginning to change in that sphere, however. There is now a junior board which has been formed, and I think this has been stimulated by Gideon Teplitz, who is an Israeli, who is now the manager of the orchestra and executive vice president. And this junior board has some good, solid Jewish names on it. These are people in their 30s and trying to stimulate interest among the younger generation to participate in the activities and buy tickets. The interesting thing is that if you look around the symphony audience, compared to the numbers in the community, the Jews far outdistance the number of Gentiles who use the orchestra facilities. So that's just another example. The opera was similar examples. We because of Beverly Sills, Beverly came to Pittsburgh and introduced us to the new head of the opera, whose picture is here also somewhere with Beverly, and Tito Capobianco and his wife Gigi have been here for dinner. Beverly has been with them. So again, we've never been asked. It's a question of the corporate structure. If you're part of a major corporation and your corporation gives a major amount of money, but other than that, there's no room to include people. Your board of directors and the people who run the opera, we know all of them. There are no Jews among them. It's a very interesting phenomenon. I won't say no Jews. There are a few. There's the Katzes, who gave huge sums of money. We know that. There's Donnie Robinson, large sums of money. But very few, and none because they were regular supporters, regular contributors, fundraisers, whatever you want, and only at a minimum, only in a token sense. So these are the things that we've run into. I think that there is a need of these organizations. The more government forecloses helping intellectual and institutions of this sort, the more they're going to have to depend on the Jewish community. And as I say, with the Knopf Junior board, that, and the fact that they appointed Donnie Moore as president is an indication to me that they realize they've got to expand their horizons.
Dr. Karp was director for years.
For years. And he's certainly Jewish. But he didn't really participate in the Jewish community. But all the directors have been Jewish. And now Lauren Mazel, of course, who's retiring next year, also of Jewish origin. So these are some of our experiences in the community. We understand it. We don't take umbrage at it. We don't carry a chip on our shoulder. We participate. My wife, for example, has been chairman of many committees, has helped give parties for them, as I said, arrange for annual events, been on those committees, so that we participate. But never are we ever asked to take a major role. It's very interesting. You asked me to talk a little. That's about enough on that subject. Let me just say, you were interested in the question of the...
Wait, stop.
You asked me about what happened to the Hebrew Institute. I think I've covered that, but if I didn't, the Hebrew Institute ran out of students. It was simple. There were too few after-school students to maintain the Hebrew Institute as such. Therefore, the Hebrew Institute essentially has become, under the United Jewish Federation, an institution of a